And this is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The question we'll be talking about here this morning is torture ever justified? How do we think about it? What is it? Some people would say, well, you know, if the question here was that there were many lives at stake, that we might sacrifice the well-being of the individual to save the lives of the many. Our guest for this morning, David Sussman, who is assistant professor of philosophy here at the University of Illinois, says, well, we ought to think very carefully about this, that torture somehow is different than other forms of violence, and not just because it is a form of violence. He makes the argument that there's something morally special about torture that really sets it apart, something that we find more offensive than other ways of inflicting great physical and psychological harm. We'll talk about some of these ideas here this morning with him. And, of course, welcome questions, as always. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And the toll-free line, which is good for anyone if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That is 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions, comments are welcome. We just ask people to be brief in their comments just so we can keep things moving along. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to join the conversation. Well, thank you very much.
Good morning.
For being here. Just before we got going here, I asked the question, and I think it might be an interesting place to start, about how it is that this was something that you started thinking about and writing about. And I know that you wrote a paper that was published a few years back. Mm-hmm. And you ended up being a go-to guy for torture. People wanted to talk to somebody who had thought about this. They called you, and I know that that's not altogether really happy about being known as the torture guy.
Yeah, I'm maybe a torture guy now, but not to monopolize this wonderful field. But I started thinking about this, this was in 2001. The first work started in 2001, shortly after 9/11, when there were a variety of public discussions about using torture and things that you might think are torture, and related questions about how narrowly or how broadly we should understand that prohibition. And it's a good question. I work in moral philosophy, and I was frustrated by what seemed like the lack then of what most people who work in ethics and most of the work in ethics had to bring to that. There just didn't seem to be a lot of good philosophical literature that would help navigate these questions in strange circumstances and difficult circumstances, which you might think is the sort of thing that if philosophy has something to offer more broadly, this is what you would look to philosophy for. And so my work just began as an attempt to be able to say something more than the very sort of quick things that pretty much everyone says out of the gate and which are sensible, but which to me seem not to really get the full substance of the issue.
Yeah. And I certainly would not want to make it sound like as if you were the only person who had thought about this or written about it, because particularly again, since 9/11, certainly over the last few years, I think more and more has been written about it. People have been encouraged to think about it, to think about what it is and why we use it and should we use it. But I think something here is particularly interesting is that before that, it seems to me that there almost would have been no discussion in this sense, that when the torture question would be brought up, people would right away say, well, we don't even need to talk about that. Of course torture is wrong. We're not going to do it. We don't even need to think about that. Mm-hmm. And then it seems striking to get from that point to the point where we had seemingly reasonable people starting to say, well, maybe we should think a little bit more about this, or, well, this is torture. Well, this we're maybe not so sure. That seems to be significant that the whole thing was opened up for that kind of discussion. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A lot of my anxiety, too, was the sense that whatever – if you have a sense – many people have the sense, I have the sense – that there is something special about torture and are tempted to think and often do think, that this is one of the few instances of a kind of act that is just categorically wrong. Mm. Either that's true or there's reason to think why you're tempted to think that. If you can't say a little bit more about why that is, that can seem readily to be something like, well, what we have here is a kind of a taboo, a shibboleth, something that's important to sort of we're used to paying lip service to, but under the pressure of real difficult circumstances, is in a certain way a fraud that we, in times of crisis, we have to move past. It makes sense that we should teach people to think this way under normal circumstances, but in extraordinary circumstances, we have to realize that that's just, you know, a useful kind of attitude to inculcate. I don't think that's true. I didn't think that was true. But again, the trick was then, well, what more do you say, as opposed to speaking louder, repeating certain sentiments about the importance of human dignity, inhumane treatment. I mean, these are, I think, all true things, but they're the kinds of conclusions that can seem like, again, just slogans that will not hold up under pressure. I don't think they're just slogans. And I've been trying, and other people have been trying, to maybe, though, say a little bit about that. That's not just, again, table pounding or raising your voice or posturing. I'm afraid this is a issue that attracts immense amounts of posturing on all sides. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to get past that. It's very easy when talking about torture to not really think about torture, not talk about torture, not argue about torture, but to think about yourself thinking about torture, think about how you appear talking about torture. It defines you readily as either a hard-headed realist in a certain way, someone who's not squeamish or afraid to get their hands dirty, or it defines you as perhaps in your rejection of it, someone high-minded in a certain edifying way. There are all sorts of edifying fantasies that people indulge in this discussion. It's very hard to just talk about the issue without filtering things through that. Mm-hmm. And I'm guilty of this too, but I've tried in some way to clear aside some of that self-defining posturing.
One of the big questions, maybe it is the place that you have to start, is, well, what is torture? And certainly, I'm sure that a lot of people would have definitions. The United Nations has a definition. And in fact, I think it was just last week we marked the anniversary of the UN Convention on Torture. So they have clearly laid out what it is. Mm-hmm. But it seems that in this conversation, there a lot of people have spent a lot of time talking about what is or isn't. There, I suppose the idea is, oh, well, you're trying to figure out what if you're going to use that euphemism, enhanced interrogation, you know, what is it that you can do and what you can't? Why does it seem to be that this is a difficult thing to pin down?
Well, I'm tempted to think to reply. This is a quotation of Nietzsche's. This is something Nietzsche says in his discussion of punishment in the genealogy. He says nothing that has a history can be defined. Where his point – what does that mean? The point seems to be something like anything that's tied – anything that's an interesting category for reasoning, for political reasoning, for moral reasoning that has functioned in different contexts, has served different purposes, has been important in various ways is going to bring with it a host of different meanings and associations, none of which – or – not all of which anyway. It's not – and one has to make a choice about what's central, what's peripheral. One has to interpret it. It's not a sort of natural kind that presents itself as a thing with definite boundaries in the world. Torture certainly has a long history. It's been thought of in many contexts. And this is, I think, exacerbated if the category in question, like punishment or cruelty in general – is a moral category, because there's a question of in sorting out what counts as torture, we're usually, and I think we should be, also thinking about what's wrong with it, what can justify it. It's not as it were something that can be identified, the way a chair can be identified, without also weighing in on how it's important, how we should care about it. Different views about why something is important, how it's important, is going to put some pressure on how we understand just what the thing is. This is true with many normative categories. I take it torture is a normative category. It's not now, the UN, the Convention Against Torture that you cite, the definition it gives there is, I suppose it's the infliction of severe pain or suffering by agents of the state, right, under color of law, for and then, for example, for certain kinds of purposes. Although not, interestingly, pain or suffering, it says, pursuant to legal sanction. Now, as a legal definition and as something that's serving the purposes of the convention, that's probably a good definition. But it's not a good moral definition, right? That's a definition that means no private person, no person who isn't acting as an agent of the government can torture someone. Only state actors can torture. That's an odd conclusion. It also means that it's not possible to torture someone as part of punishment, right? Torture is not incident upon legal sanctions of the state. It doesn't seem like – I mean, torture has been a familiar and longstanding part of practices of punishment for a long, long time. And you might think the notion of inflicting pain and suffering, one might have to say more about the context. Perhaps what counts as pain and suffering, but what counts as the situation. I mean, pain and suffering are inflicted in warfare. Police inflict pain and suffering in the proper performance of their duties. These things needn't count as torture. There are a bunch of things that seem to be assumed there. And which you might want to make clear. Now, the sorts of and which do come up, I mean, they've been exploited in, I think, disingenuous ways by, you know, the Bush administration discussions around how to define torture. I don't think they're philosophically interesting, whether, say, waterboarding is torture. I think it's philosophical because it obviously is. I don't think there's any good faith argument that can be made to call that into question. Might be justifiable. But whether that would be an instance of torture, I, you know, that's not the case of people arguing seriously. But there are interesting questions about things like sensory deprivation, solitary confinement, disorientation, various forms of manipulation and intimidation that have gotten called torture light, which you might wonder, you might think they're morally distinct from beatings, electric shock, partial drowning, right? Canonical instances of torture. I mean, there is space for wondering about how broad the category should be construed, even if you put aside the sort of disingenuous manipulations of the, you know, the Gonzales Justice Department.
Yeah. Before talking some more about the moral argument or the moral questions, there is a I guess one would call it the utilitarian argument about torture that says, well, we shouldn't do this. And a lot of people who have been involved – have been interrogators and have been done that kind of work would say, well, we really shouldn't do this because you can't trust the information that you get. Ultimately, you're defeating yourself by using that as a means, and that they would say, we know we have other better means. If we're trying to get someone to tell us something that they are not inclined to, there are better ways to do this. And so they would say, well, that should be argument enough for against using torture. And I think that you might be inclined to say, well, yes, in fact, that those are good solid arguments, but it's necessary to go the further step.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as a practical matter, as a question of what policies we should be adopting, what we should be answering, I don't think there's a very clear case to be made that the general utilitarian or consequentialist, or you might say cost-benefit arguments, that if the supposed justification of torture is gaining useful information that's needed to stop terrorist attacks or other terrible things. The costs of this, particularly as a practice, particularly when you factor in long-term effects on institutions, on responses of other countries, on how our own service people are going to be treated, on the rule of law generally, when one actually looks past the immediate circumstances involved in a crisis that would make it seem tempting, and one just looks broadly at all the downstream consequences, it looks like this is just not going to be a smart thing to do. And if it's not a smart – particularly when there seem to be superior alternatives, particularly in light of unreliability of information and in light of superior, more effective alternatives, in light of all – this turns out to be a stupid strategy, an imprudent strategy. And if it's stupid, it's certainly not morally justified. If it's stupid, it's also wicked. And as things stand now, I think that's true. And I think most people who have examined this issue broadly, not everyone, but most people, think as a matter of fact that's true. So I don't think there's sort of – one has to look to it to settle any subtle philosophical questions to address those most pressing political problems. But there is, you know, the broader question, okay, that's true. But any sort of – that kind of cost-benefit profile is the sort of thing that could change. One could develop emergencies of greater magnitude could emerge. Different forms of torture could emerge with different degrees of efficacy. There could be forms of reliable torture. I don't think there are that I know of, but I don't see anything about the very idea of torture that rules out the possibility of, you know, with greater psychological sophistication, really effective ones or ones that can be made reliable or circumstances facing certain kinds of enemies in which there aren't decent alternatives. Those seem to me all real possibilities. The world – I mean that would be surprising if we ended up in such a situation, but it wouldn't – you don't need a really wild science fiction example to get that going. And there, so part of the question is how much of the argument depends upon a certain kind of cost-benefit profile, which is an empirical matter. It's a matter of psychology. It's a matter of political science, remaining the same. Or to what extent are there objections which don't depend on those things? Mm-hmm. And a lot of the public argument has been on what you call the utilitarian considerations, in part because no one denies that they're relevant. That this is a bar that would have to be cleared to even raise the question of justifiable torture. And there's a lot to be said about those things. Those are things it's easier to argue about because one moves quickly to arguing about psychological matters, broader political matters, and there are smart people with methods who know how to find that out. Mm. These are questions – I guess this is why they remain philosophical questions where you're not really sure what counts as relevant beyond that, what its significance is, how to bring that in. And that's why I think these are interestingly philosophical questions rather than questions pursued by, you know, respectable disciplines with methodologies and bodies of knowledge and all those things philosophy doesn't have.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is David Sussman. He is assistant professor of philosophy here at the University of Illinois. We're talking about torture, something that he has written about. Now, he's not the only person who has, but he wrote a paper. The title of the paper was What's Wrong with Torture? It was published a number of years ago and has gotten a lot of attention, and people have engaged him on this since. And that's what we're talking about here this morning. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, if I think that what you seem to be, the ideas you seem to be looking at in this paper in particular have to do with the nature of torture, what it is, why it has the effects on people that it does. And I think you make the point that, you can say that, there's pain and suffering, physical and psychological, in warfare. And you know, it may be either intended or not intended. There's pain and suffering involved in as people go through the justice system. So that's the fact that there might be pain and suffering associated with torture, well, then you might say, well, that's really not that much different from these other things. Mm-hmm. But you're saying something that I think is really interesting, and it starts you thinking more about, well, what torture is and the effect that it has on people. You say, well, actually, there is something about it that's different from those other things, mm-hmm. that sets it apart, quite apart from the fact that, yes, pain and suffering, psychological and physical, are associated with it. And it has to do with this idea that the whole purpose of it is the way that it turns the person against himself or mm-hmm. herself. At least that's the way that I would, in a very simple way, that's the way that I would express it.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Part of the challenge of the paper was, it's certainly the case that torture has grievous effects on people, psychologically, physically, right? It's immense forms of suffering. But then so does warfare, right? And you might think anything, what are the limits to how horribly people get treated in warfare? Well, it's not clear that there are any limits. Nevertheless, we think there are justifiable instances of using incendiaries and things that rip people's bodies apart and things like that. So if you're just appealing to the distinctively – but the very great psychological harms and physical harms of torture, well, right, that's another harm. But then again, that might be a harm perpetrated to prevent similar harms being suffered by others, being suffered by more people, and that might be a harm you're perpetrating against someone who is in some ways guilty of setting in motion precisely those processes that are going to inflict these harms on others. Mm-hmm. So it seems that if you want to go beyond the kind of utilitarian considerations, there's a matter here not just of thinking what is the magnitude of the harm. That's just a question of, again, adjusting what the costs and the cost-benefit analysis properly are. And this is where the paper gets weird. Trying to understand torture as an instance of a kind of relationship between individuals, which is fundamentally perverted in a way, mm-hmm. where a perverted relationship is not just a relationship in which bad things are brought about of a certain kind, but it's a fundamentally an anti-human relationship. It inverts the structure of normal, decent human relationships in a way which is offensive, is morally objectionable, in a way that goes beyond the badness of producing the category these harms. Not to deny that the badness of causing these harms is very important, but there's something that goes beyond it, which is right? So the importance of not torturing is to be understood. Well, for some people would argue, torture does very bad things to people. Warfare does really bad things to people. Warfare is sometimes justified. Torture, not. And one is tempted to say, but that's because the harms of torture are vastly worse than even the harms inflicted in warfare. This strikes me as puzzling. The harms of warfare involve burning people up and mm-hmm. ripping their bodies apart, mm-hmm. and these seem pretty high. Which would mean, if that were the case, if it were just the magnitude of the harms, if one were facing a situation where you could prevent some people from being, say, killed, right, by bullets and bombs, or you could prevent same number of people from being tortured, it would be morally wrong to prevent the people from being killed rather than preventing the people from being tortured, because the gravity of the harms of the torture victims is significantly greater than the gravity of the harms of those who are killed. That seems wrong to me. I don't think it would be wrong to keep the people from being killed rather than keeping the other people who won't be killed from being tortured. I don't think if I was offered a choice, sorry, this is what we do, you know, between being tortured, not killed, but being tortured mm-hmm. and being killed, not tortured, I don't think it would be unreasonable of me to choose to be tortured rather than to be killed. Although if the gravity of the harms of torture were somehow vastly greater than the harms of being killed, that would be an unreasonable choice.
Hmm.
Right? So thinking that way, one starts looking for something about what's going on in torture that's not cashed out into magnitudes of the harm that then, you know, set up these weird situations. And the thing that I emphasize, and this is what the article tries to explore, is a certain way in which torture involves a victim. First of all, that torture depends less on pain and suffering, although it depends on pain and suffering, but primarily on fear, on exposure, on vulnerability, on disorientation, on making a person unable to orient themselves, cope, defend themselves, a certain kind of, again, exposure. I think that's quite crucial to the experience of torture. Now, pain, suffering, and threats of pain and suffering are very effective ways of doing that. But I think the core thing is that kind of open-ended disorientation and vulnerability that inculcates a kind of desperate betrayal of oneself that is on the victim's part in the attempt to anticipate, appease, deal with another person who they can't figure out, who has control over all information, who has no apparent limits on their behavior, and that this actually takes the form characteristically of a kind of collusion against oneself, mm-hmm. a kind of self-betrayal. And the thing I try to argue in the article is there's something about putting someone in that position, not just of betraying – of not just of harming them, but of a very profound sort of experience of self-betrayal in very intimate aspects of themselves, which is morally different from just inflicting a harm and has a special kind of objectionability to move into that relation with someone. I don't argue in the paper that torture is categorically wrong. In fact, I can think of particular kinds of instances where that objection could be overcome. But it does show why how you think about justifying it and what's necessary to justify it is not just a special instance of the justification of violence in general. There's the character of the objection is wrong, and that's going to mean that the way you reason about justifying it could be importantly different as well.
Well, let me just take it, and I have a caller here, and I want to make sure these folks know we'll get to them. But to just to go to take that just a little bit further, because I think here you're dealing with some very important questions, and ultimately the question is, well, how, you know, how do human beings deal with one another, and what do you do and what do you not, and why? And the thing that I'm sort of wrestling with is, what is it in this relationship? Because you said, well, really what's important here is the relationship between the torturer and the victim.
Yeah.
And the fact that you put the victim into this situation where he has no control, completely at the mercy of the torturer, maybe not even quite sure what the torturer wants or what their intent are. Certainly the idea is once you want to instill in that person the idea that this is completely open-ended. That is, mm-hmm. I can do anything that comes into my head to you,
mm-hmm.
and you cannot do anything about it. And that what you're trying to do is to take advantage of disorientation, the fear that comes about, the breaking down of that person,
mm-hmm.
till you get to the point where they cannot possibly resist, and then they will presumably tell you anything that you want to know or do anything that you mm-hmm. that you want. I guess the question is, why is that wrong? I mean, what is wrong with doing that to another human being to the point where you would say that we have a moral question here, and apart from any of the other reasons that you would have for saying not to do this, here's my bottom line reason not to do this, mm-hmm. that it has to do with the effect on the person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. So why isn't that just another consequence of that's a bad thing?
Yeah.
See, part of where I've situated this argument is against a different kind of philosophical understanding of what morality is about, quite basically. Mm-hmm. That is one different from the sort of utilitarian approach, which is attending to, you know, costs and benefits in terms of harms brought and benefits brought to people. A broadly Kantian approach, which understands the basic point of morality not as a matter of producing certain kinds of outcomes, but as standing in certain kinds of relations with people that are inherently, you'd say, respectful or that recognize others, that have a kind of implicit understanding of others as other people, that is, as other agents who have their own lives, who have their own perspectives, who are, you would say, autonomous or self-directing in a certain way, and where the fact that your life is your life in that way, you're not just another thing in the world available for my use, but that your life, but you have a world in which I, show up, and that you are a locus of concerns, worries, ideas, I mean, perhaps quite wicked ones, that requires a different kind of attitude. Not just that's a good thing to promote, it's a thing to be valued, but it's something with a kind of standing or authority. Sorry, there's a whole bunch of stuff in the background. If you have a kind of picture like that, that morality is an expression of the appreciation of other people as not just other things that can enjoy things or suffer, but as other loci of caring about things, worrying about things, judgment, and that has to be accorded a certain kind of authority, a certain kind of respect, different from valuable objects, then the thought is not only does torture not respect that. I mean, that's true, but then you might say coercion doesn't respect that, and violence often doesn't respect that. Mm. It doesn't just fail to respect the value, but in a way it mocks the value. It's not just a failing to respect, but a travesty, an inversion of the structure of that relationship, such that if the violation of that value is bad, is objectionable, then the inversion of it, a kind of mockery of that, is bad in a more profound way. Right? There's a difference between, say, if you think of valuing the flag, I'm sorry, this is a terrible example, but if you think one should respect the flag, United States of America, now you could fail to value it, show it that kind of respect by leaving it out in the rain, letting it get tattered, right? That would be one way of failing it. Another way of doing it could be using it to line your birdcage, right? Or using it as toilet paper, right? And you think, right, those are different. I mean, both of those are in some ways failure to honor whatever is at stake there, but they're failures in profoundly different ways. I'm understanding torture on analogy to that, the lining the birdcage way.
We have a couple of callers here, and we're moving into about our last 15 minutes. Our guest is David Sussman. He is assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Illinois. We're talking about torture. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The first is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello, Professor Sussman. You've touched on this, but maybe you would tell us what you would say directly to people who raise this kind of defense of the practice of torture in casual conversation. One is, of course, the ticking time bomb scenario, which keeps coming up again and again, which seems to me to presuppose you can know some things that you typically in the real world you cannot possibly know. And secondly, the who can say argument, which you've, again, touched upon. Who can say exactly what is and what is not torture? And perhaps we should just call it enhanced interrogation technique. So what do you reply to people who use that line in ordinary conversation and or not when we're not writing philosophical papers?
Uh-huh.
I'll hang up. Thanks.
Sure. I'll take the ticking time bomb. Right. So this is the example that keeps coming up,
right,
for good or ill, which is, of course, many instances of objectionable torture. But say you've captured a terrorist. They're part of a plot that's placed, you know, a nuclear weapon in Manhattan, and time is running out, and it seems like the only way to locate the thing is to torture this person. Would you say in that instance you wouldn't torture? Now, I agree with the caller, and this comes up frequently, usually the circumstances here are idealized. That is, there are many things assumed about the case which typically very often wouldn't hold, so that you actually know to a high enough degree of certainty that this is the case, that the person you have is actually involved in this, they actually have the requisite information. There are all sorts of things that there aren't alternative, superior ways of doing this. This is all assuming many things, which in any real case you couldn't just assume. And so any real case is going to be messier than that. That said, and some people then just reject the hypothetical as being this hypothetical case as being too idealized. This is not a circumstance that could ever be realized in the world, and so why reason from it? This isn't my attitude. It'd be one thing if the hypothetical involved things so bizarre that our intuitions couldn't get around it. Philosophy gets weird science fiction hypotheticals. This I don't think is that weird. I think there could be circumstances that conform to this. I think it's certainly a case many things that people might think are a case like this may not be such a case, and so one should look at any such circumstances, supposed circumstances, very carefully before drawing this conclusion. So I concede all those points. But let me bite the bullet here. In this case, were it to satisfy the requisite standards, you know, all these conditions, which in reality are going to be seldom, and it's going to be seldom, and we should be very careful before we jump to the conclusion that a case meets these specifications, particularly since we're going to err on the side of being too ready to do these kinds of things. In the case particularly of someone who is actually complicit in the placing of the bomb, I think this is a morally important factor, whether the person is involved in the actual attack or whether they're a person who knows about it but is not actually one of the perpetrators. That's a morally important distinction. Torture could be justified in such a case. Now, what that gets exploited on in casual conversation and not so casual conversation, the conclusion is then made, if you grant it in this case, right, in this extreme case, then you've really given up the argument. This is the thin end of the wedge. Mm. If you're willing, these are points Donald Lubin's made very well, if you're willing to torture when there's, say, 100% chance that if you don't, a million people will die, then you're going to be willing to torture if there's a 50% chance that 2 million people will die if you don't. And if there's a 25% chance that 4 million people will die, right? All you've done at that point is set up a kind of pricing structure, right, for decisions. Hmm. If you admit it at any point, right? And then you've basically accepted a consequentialist line on this. It's that inference that I would reject. That is, if I accept, as I guess I'll accept, that in a case where it looks like if we don't torture this complicit person, there's a 100% chance that 8 million people, you know, New York population will be annihilated in fire, then it follows I have to be willing to torture in cases where that's much less likely or I'm much less sure about this, but the stakes are higher. That I don't think follows, mm-hmm. right? That there is actually a moral distinction between emergency circumstances in which threats are immediate and very highly probable, may not know anything with certainty, but very, very high degrees of probability, that that doesn't then sort of set up a reasoning structure that justifies torture, even in cases where there's very little chance that doing this will have any beneficial effect, but it's a very small chance it'll have a very wide effect. That I don't think follows. One would need more argument about why there's a difference between imminent crisis and more regular sorts of situation. But that's where I'd appeal to block that consideration.
Well, if we can, and again, I have another caller I want to get to, but if we can talk just a second about the other question, because I think that's, you know, a lot of the discussion about torture has been talking about particular procedures, and people are saying, well, okay, how about this? What about putting a person in a freezing cold room?
Yep.
What about preventing them from sleeping? What about waterboarding? What, you know, what about other sorts of things? And so people have said, is this torture? Well, what about this? And well, what about this?
Good. Right. You might just think we're arguing about a word here, and that's not an interesting thing. And insofar as it is a purely verbal dispute, it's probably not interesting. But if you said, no, the reason we have the word is because there is a distinctive type of objectionable act there, which isn't captured just by the term violence. Right, it's something specific. It might admit of gradations. I think the question then becomes, what's really a central example of that? What are the examples that capture what we're worried about here most clearly, and which we then, when we reason about other things like waterboarding or sleep deprivation, we use those as sort of our points of orientation. And I mean, the way to argue about it, I think, is, well, people will choose different central examples and then say something, sort of highlight, what do you think, what is it about this that makes this different from other kinds of violence or other kinds of cruelty? That's sort of what I've tried to do in the paper, is I'm trying to focus, say, away from pain. Some discussions focus on physical pain and somehow treat, you know, non-physically engendered pain as somehow secondary. This seems insane to me, but sometimes people take that seriously. So one question might be, how, you know, is the central thing the causing of pain, causing of physical pain, causing of physical harm? Some people seem to think that was a big deal. John Yoo seemed to think that was a big deal, but that can't really be taken seriously. I'm trying to refocus around ideas of vulnerability, exposure, and being sort of confronted with a world that's, on the one hand, saturated, or the expression of the will of someone else. Someone else is in control, right? It's not an indifferent world. It's a world full of another person, but a person who is not really predictable, who cannot be replied to, who cannot be countered in any way. And whether, if you look at it through that lens, things that didn't seem to be related get refocused and grouped together in ways that seem to make sense. I think that's the only way to argue about it.
Well, I want to get our other caller in here in Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I find this whole discussion actually very torturous and pretty repugnant, and I assume you do get that kind of response. I haven't heard anybody elicit it, and it's probably not very productive, I suppose, so maybe I will eschew it. But one of the points that people who are ex-CIA people say is that it really doesn't work unless you actually, you know what you want to hear to begin with, in the idea that this particular instance of Al-Libi, who eventually was rendered to Libya and supposedly committed suicide there after he was rendered extraordinarily around various parts of the world, and he's the fellow that said, oh, of course, the Iraqis are teaching al-Qaeda about chemical weapons, which he reneged upon almost immediately when the screws were taken off of him. So, I mean, I'm just saying there's a utilitarian argument that you're not exploring. I think it's it shouldn't be necessary to make that particular argument, because as Obama, who is compromised in this regard in some instances, is saying that one of the drawbacks of being a torturous nation is that you have no particular standing to criticize other nations in the world that you you want to without being a hypocrite, which is generally what's been done. So obviously this is pretty far afield from your I just how would you respond to some of those dimensions of the problem that you have? I would also like for the host to commit to having Alfred McCoy on. He's extensively studied torture and its analysis, sort of codification by the CIA, and has quite a few interesting things to say about it. I don't think you've had him on before, so
no, we can
please do.
All right,
I'll listen to the philosopher.
Okay. Well, I didn't have too much to say about those kinds of consequences just because I think all those points are right, and they're not terribly controversial. And so, again, as a practical matter about forming policy now, I concede that even if there were no special moral objection to torture, those kinds of fundamentally prudential arguments – and again, if torture isn't effective or prudential, it can't be morally right either are clearly true about the world as it is now. Again, my interest. So the reason I don't explore those things is just because I don't think they're controversial. My question was how much of the case against torture depends on those things being true, and how much depends on it remaining true. These things could change. I don't know why necessarily there couldn't be such a thing as reliable torture. I mean, there are many unreliable forms of intelligence gathering, which. If you do them right or you expand them the right way, you find ways of checking, can be their reliability can be increased, maybe to whatever point they become useful. I don't know why offhand that couldn't be the case with torture, though I'm sure it's not the case with torture as it is now.
We're coming to the point where we have just a couple of minutes left. Something that I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about, apart from the specific thing that we're talking about here, is how it is that somebody like you, or how the discipline of philosophy can guide us through life, because I'm sure that you know, you ask philosophers, well, I'm sure philosophers tell you, well, one of the things that philosophy is supposed to be good for is that it gives you some way to think about questions like this, these very questions like, well, should I do this or should I not? Mm-hmm. And you know, somebody like you write papers. You talk with other philosophers. Maybe you come on shows like this. I guess I wonder, is there actually a way – do you feel that there's actually a way for philosophy to get into the public square, so to speak, mm-hmm. and to be involved in helping people actually try to answer questions like this? Sure. Does it happen?
It does happen, and there are a few very good philosophers who have become sort of much more – you might – say public intellectuals, who do engage much more broadly in real policy, real debates. And I think that's a good thing to do. I do think there's a useful division of labor between people who are more immediately engaged in public forums and public ways. And then, you know, the people who are off in more esoteric pursuits, not so much focused on what's happening today, what's happening in the headlines. It's not that those things aren't important, but there are people talking about that. But our stepping back from that hopefully is a resource that can be in conversation with good public intellectuals. I just think there needs to be a division of labor between, you know, the more esoteric who are sort of at a distance of the quick motion of things and the people who are actually engaging in ways that actually involve knowing something about the world in its particulars, which I have no expertise in.
Hmm. Well, now that you know, we talked in the beginning of the program about how, as a result of having written about this, you end up being on programs like this, and people ask you. Not that you're the only person to write on these subjects, but is as a philosopher, what's this done for you? Other than you know, made put you in the position of talking about something that's really. Repugnant to use the term of the last caller.
Well, it's brought me into conversation with people outside of philosophy, there's a lot of interest in history and psychology and law in ways which are sometimes quite frustrating just because failure to make contact, but also can be sort of illuminating in ways too. So, and there, you know, there's perennial interest in this, and for some reason there isn't the same kind of interest in, you know, Kant's theory of agency. So, you know, it's broadening if frustrating in the way that talking with other people is usually broadening and frustrating.
Well, we're at the point here where we're going to have to finish. My apologies. We have one more caller that we can't take, but we are at the end of the time, and we'll have to say thanks to our guest, David Sussman. He is assistant professor of philosophy here at the University of Illinois.
Great. Thank
thanks
you
very
much.
Thank you for being with us.